studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. My guest this week is artist and author Floyd Norman. As an animator, he worked at Walt Disney Studios. His work can be seen in Sleeping Beauty and The Sword in the Stone, The Jungle Book, Robin Hood, Mulan, Dinosaur, and The Hunchback of Notre Dame, as well as Toy Story and many other films. He is the author of several books, including Faster, Cheaper, Son of Faster, Cheaper, and How the Grinch Stole Disney. His latest is My Animated Life. Floyd Norman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Gary.
You got your start in comic books. Katie Keene, what was it?
Yes, back in high school. Talk about being a lucky kid. Most kids get in trouble for drawing in class. I was able to get a job out of it.
And so how did you get into comic books?
Well, I used to draw cartoons in my science class, Santa Barbara High School, and my science teacher happened to play golf in the afternoon with a local cartoonist by the name of Bill Wagon. Mm. Now, Bill did a comic book for Archie Comics, and it was called Katie Keene, the Fashion Queen. And it was very popular, especially with young women and girls, very popular back in the 50s.
And how long did you work for that book?
Well, I started working for Bill when I was still in high school, so probably a couple of my high school years, that is, a lot of the work I did in the summertime when school was out. And even after I left Santa Barbara to go to art school, I would still do a page or two for Bill. Even when I was out of town, I would do some freelance work for him. But I owe him a lot because he was the guy who gave me my first professional job in the comic book business.
Were you a comic book fan as well, or did you just draw cartoons for your own amusement?
Oh, I was a total comic book fan. I guess I was not unusual in the sense that a lot of kids devoured comic books back then. We didn't have all the media we have today, so comics were extremely popular. But unlike the other kids, I not only wanted to read comics, I wanted to write and draw them.
Well, so were your ambitions totally in comics, or did you look at cartoons as a possibility also?
Oh, no, I was in love with all the cartoon media. I loved comic books. I loved animated films. I loved motion pictures in general. I knew that even if I hadn't been an artist, I think I would have been drawn toward the film business. I would have done something in film. I would have been a film editor, or I would have found some job, because I found the whole business fascinating.
And you're a California native?
I grew up in Santa Barbara. I think I'm kind of a coastal person. I love being near the ocean, being near the beach. So I was lucky enough to grow up in Santa Barbara, which was truly a Pacific paradise.
So how did you then make your way from Katie Keene to Sleeping Beauty?
Well, luckily, the Walt Disney Studio is only a short 90 miles away from Santa Barbara. So once I graduated from high school, it wasn't that difficult to drive down to Burbank and the location of the Walt Disney Studio. And I did just that. A week after graduating, I was lucky enough to land an interview with the Disney Studio. And I drove down on a Saturday morning and entered the Walt Disney Studio gates for the first time in my life.
How old were you?
Oh, 17.
And did you have a portfolio of your work with you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. I had the usual kid portfolio, you know, the portfolio full of drawings and cartoons and sketches.
Who interviewed you there?
Oddly enough, it wasn't a Disney artist. It was a guy from the personnel department. Hmm. But even so, even though he was not an artist himself, the fact that he worked at Disney, he knew what he was looking at. And he gave me some good advice. He said, kid, go to school.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you went to art school?
Yeah, yeah. And that was good advice because I really wasn't ready for a job in the animation business. certainly not a professional job. I was just out of high school, and I needed additional training and schooling, and so going to school was good advice.
So you got a degree in art?
Well, even though I attended the Art Center College of Design in Los Angeles, I never did get my degree.
Uh-huh.
And here's the reason why.
Yeah.
In my third year of school, I got a call from the Walt Disney Studio asking me if I still wanted that job.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I became an instant dropout and rushed out to Burbank and took the job.
And, but you do think you benefited from your years?
Oh, you bet. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. The years in school were invaluable, yeah.
Did you do a lot of life drawing? What kinds of drawing? You know, how did it change your art or refine it?
Well, you know, what the Disney artists always say is that a young artist needs to learn the basics. And, of course, that includes life drawing and a lot of life drawing. Also, you need to study composition and design and color. So going to art school, even though I wasn't going to be a painter necessarily, it just provided that foundation that every good artist needs.
Now, you're African American. I'm sure that's not news to you.
So I'm told, yes.
And you came to work at the Walt Disney Studios. We've had three of Disney's biographers on the show here. We've had Neil Gabler on, we had Richard Schickel on, and Mark Elliott. And they all have, you know, various views of Walt in their books. And Walt has been accused of being racist, anti-Semitic, or at the best, racially insensitive. And I guess
yes.
You could look at, you know, before you got there, there was Uncle Remus and that whole Br'er Rabbit thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess cartoons and comic books were generally racially insensitive in the 1940s and 50s. What were your feelings about that?
Yeah, I think that's something that's often discussed, and I think one has to look at all of this in context. You know, the fact that the 1940s and 50s was not like today. But, you know, those things never offended me, even as a kid. I loved Disney's Song of the South, Br'er Rabbit, Uncle Remus. Those things, those cartoons were just delightful. And I never saw them as being, or maybe I was just a naive kid, but I never saw them as being racially insensitive. Perhaps looking back on it, somewhat naive,
mm-hmm.
but never, I never thought Walt Disney was in any way hostile to minorities. And then, of course, once I came to work for Disney and worked at the studio, luckily, the last 10 years of Walt Disney's life, and then finally getting the opportunity to work with Walt Disney himself, that gave me insight that I never would have had. Walt Disney was he's one of the best bosses I ever worked for, and he was certainly not an anti-Semite, and he certainly was not a racist. And I've had to state that on many occasions, and people will say, "Well, gee, how do you know that?" And I said, "Well, look, you know, I work with him. I was there."
Well, we're talking with Floyd Norman, who was an animator at Disney Studios, and you still do a lot of work. But let's talk about your early years. Your first Disney film was Sleeping Beauty. Was that the first one you worked on?
Well, that was the first feature film I worked on.
Mm-hmm. Well, so how did you start? How did they start you? As an in-betweener or what?
Oh, yes. The lowest job at the Disney Studio when you come in as a young trainee, your title is apprentice in-betweener.
Oh.
You know, so you're at the bottom of the food chain, and that's how, and you work your way up.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, back in those days, you started working on television, because that was kind of the easy stuff. And then if you did good on that, you might get a chance to work on the shorts or on some other television material for the Walt Disney, the show on ABC at the time was called Disneyland.
Right.
And I worked on a lot of those shows in those early days. And then, finally, if you can prove yourself a worthy, and this takes a while, you might get a shot at working on the Disney feature, because the feature was considered the big time.
Now, talk a little bit about the Disney style of animation. The as I understand it, a character would be assigned to an animator, or an animator would kind of latch on to a certain character. Is that how it works?
Well, it's like casting in a live-action movie. Certain animators tend to excel with certain characters. Like some animators might be very good at drawing attractive women. That's just something they do really well. Another animator might be very good at doing a villain. He's very good at doing a scary character or a very nefarious character. And so Walt knew his artists, and he knew who did what and who did it best. And so artists would often be assigned a particular character based on their own individual abilities as an artist and as an animator.
Well, how would that work if characters assigned to different animators appeared in scenes together?
Oh, in a way, it was a very good dynamic. I think a good example, this has often been cited, there's a wonderful scene in the movie Peter Pan. You've got three characters in a scene, and each character is animated by a different animator. You've got the little tubby assistant, Mr. Shmee, who was animated by Ollie Johnson. Then you had the villain, Captain Hook, animated by Frank Thomas. And then, of course, Tinkerbell was animated by the great Mark Davis. And so here you have three very different animators working together, all in the same scene, all, you know, you might say controlling or performing a particular character. And it was just wonderful to, of course, I had the opportunity to talk to these old guys when they were still with us. And they would often talk about how they worked together and how they worked out this whole performance. It's like choreography on paper, you see.
So as an in-betweener, did you in-between their work? Did you learn from their style by connecting their drawings?
I had the opportunity to work with a number of the Nine Old Men, not all of them. I never had a chance to work for Mark Davis or a few of the others, but I did work with Milt Call, Ward Kimball, John Lounsbery, on occasion Eric Larson, and Frank Thomas. So I did learn a good deal from these old guys because they were the masters. And of course, keep in mind, these are the guys who were doing the Disney cartoons when I was still a child. So I saw their work on screen when I was a little kid, and then eventually grew up, you know, and came to work with these guys, you know, at the studio. So you can imagine how a lot of us felt as kids, having seen this brilliant work on screen, and here we were now working with these masters.
Yes, it's sort of akin to, you know, working with Clark Gable or something like that.
You bet, yeah.
Yeah. Let me just ask you a little bit about Walt Disney himself.
Sure.
Do you remember the first time you met him and when you talked to him and what kind of person he was and so forth?
Well, the first time I my first Walt Disney sighting, I didn't speak to him. You have to keep in mind that even back in the 50s, Walt Disney had already become somewhat of a legendary character because, you know, good heavens, you heard his name. Eventually, you began to see him on television when he hosted the TV shows. And he was just kind of this legendary figure. So a bunch of us kids were up on the third floor of the animation building. Third floor is where Walt Disney had his office. But we were up there for a meeting, and we were out in the hallway. And this lone figure comes walking toward us, you know, down the hallway. And he's backlit by the south window, so we couldn't see who it was initially. And then as the figure came closer toward us, we realized it was Walt Disney himself. And it was as though, I don't know how to put it, if it was the President of the United States or the Pope or, you know,
God.
Or God walking down the hallway toward us. So we all kind of like backed up against the hallway as Walt walked past. And he kind of, I think he thought the whole thing was rather amusing.
And so then eventually you got to the point where you were working with him, talking to him. What was that like?
It was very respectful, I would say. Once again, keep in mind that not everybody had access to Walt Disney. So when I had a chance to move upstairs and work in the story department on The Jungle Book, suddenly I had access to the man that most people would probably never get a chance to talk to or meet with. Mainly not because Walt was standoffish, but because he was a very busy man.
Mm-hmm.
And he just didn't have time to go to every department.
What would a story session on The Jungle Book with Walt Disney be like?
Well, the story department was where Walt Disney focused most of his attention. And so if you were working in animation, layout, or background, you wouldn't see Walt that much. However, if you worked in the story department, that's where Walt focused his attention, and that's where you would meet with him. And, of course, we had story meetings whenever the boss was available. Again, we had to work around his schedule. Again, he had his many irons in the fire. He was a very busy man.
Mm-hmm.
But his sessions were intense, pointed, and very insightful. I can't tell you what an opportunity it was for this kid. Keep in mind, I was still in my 20s at the time I was meeting with Disney, so I was still very much a kid. But having the opportunity to meet with the story master in person and to gain his advice and his insight, and also to get balled out by him, too.
Oh, yeah.
I still consider that an honor and a privilege.
What had you done that got you balled out, do you recall?
Oh, well, sometimes we would often think that we were not doing our best on the movie, and would sometimes, you know, talk back to Walt and say, well, gee, Walt, I don't think this is a good idea, or I don't think this is working. And he would just put us in our place and say, look, this is fine the way it is. Don't mess with it, and let me worry about it, you know. And so we came to understand that this guy had been around making movies since the 1930s, and he did know a bit more than we did. And if we were smart, we'd keep our mouths shut and just follow his advice, which we did.
He was usually right then.
He was almost always right.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was there a dress code at the Disney Studios, I wonder?
No, not at all. It was extremely casual. We were also on a first name basis.
Really? So you called him Walt?
Yes. He insisted that everybody be called by their first name. He insisted that we called him Walt.
And did he know everybody's name?
Oh, he sure did. And that I found amazing, because when I think of all of the people who worked at that studio, he knew us all.
Well, we're talking with Floyd Norman, the great animator. And while you were working on The Jungle Book, that was in 1966, I believe.
Right, that's correct.
That's also the year that Walt passed away. Had you finished the film when he died, or were still working on it?
The film was still in production, but we had finished the story. We knew Walt was ill back in 1966. We just never realized the extent of his illness. No. And keep in mind, we were still meeting with Disney throughout 1966 as we were working on story on The Jungle Book. And although at times he appeared, a little tired, and on occasion somewhat grumpy, we just thought it was the usual pressure and stress of work. And though we knew that he had some health issues, mainly because of his smoking habit, we just never knew that how badly this thing had gotten. And of course, the lung cancer is what eventually took his life.
Were you at the studio at the time when you heard of his death?
I was at the studio the day before.
Mm-hmm.
I was away that Friday. It was ironic that on that Thursday afternoon at the studio, I inquired with one of the guards at the front gate, a guy named Bill, who was a guard, and I said, "Well, how's the boss doing? How's Walt doing?" He says, "Oh, he's across the street at St. Joseph's Hospital. We think he went over for a checkup." And Walt had just had surgery a couple of months earlier, I believe. And so when we heard he was at the hospital, we thought, "Oh, I guess he's doing good. He's gone back just for a checkup because of the surgery." And of course, the very next day, the news came that Walt had passed away that Friday morning.
So quite a shock then.
It was an incredible shock. You know, it's funny. We should have known better. We knew that the man was not well. But the idea of Walt passing away just did not seem real.
So how did the studio change, you know, before and after Walt?
Well, it changed profoundly. Keep in mind that this was a studio that was, it was Walt's studio. He sort of guided every project. He oversaw everything that was done. And so when we lost Walt Disney, it's almost as though the studio sort of drifted for nearly 10 years trying to get its bearings. It's like a ship that's lost its captain, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you think the films definitely suffered after that?
Well, I think everything suffered after we lost Walt, and it took us a number of years of kind of floundering, trying to find ourselves. And you know, it's amazing. It never really happened, I think, until into the 80s, and we started to pull it together and begin to make some pretty good films, or at least the films we were doing showed potential that the studio could rally and that it could carry on even without Walt.
Were you there, still at the studio when the big rally, you know, happened with the Little Mermaid and all that?
I had been away. I had been away for a while. I actually left Disney and I launched my own company for a while. So I did work outside of Disney.
Now, you were doing a lot of Saturday morning cartoon kinds of things? Or other
things? I did a bit of that. Initially, I left to produce educational films for the schools. And I enjoyed that very much. And part of my leaving was because it was, you know, it was really difficult to continue on without Walt Disney. And I thought when I left, I wondered if I would ever return to the studio. But eventually, I did come back. Maybe in a way it was kind of like, you know, coming home again. Eventually I came back, and by the time we moved into the early 80s, things began to change. A lot of the older guys had retired or passed away, and we had a lot of young kids coming in, young kids with some bright ideas and new approaches. Kids would eventually kind of like lead an animation revolution. Keep in mind, we had guys like John Lasseter, Brad Bird, Tim Burton. All of these guys were just kids out of school. And they came into Disney, and in a way, they came in to lead the studio in a new direction.
Well, so given that late 60s, 70s era of animation, are you surprised that feature animation is as popular as it is now? It has its own Academy Award category and so forth.
Well, I think animated features have always been popular. It was pretty much an area Disney had to itself for decades. You know, keep in mind, there were hardly any competitors who could compete with Disney. Many tried and many failed. But now I look at animation, and it's an incredibly robust business. I mean, we've got studios that didn't exist before who are, in a sense, competition for Disney. Although I don't look at it as competition, I think it's just great to have all of this.
The more cartoons, the better.
Yeah, the more films, the better.
What about the style of animation? It kind of went through some profound changes during the time that you were working at Disney, and even during Disney's lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
The style of the Jungle Book is a lot different than the style of even The Sword in the Stone, which was not that far behind it.
Well, yeah, styles change, and technology changes things, too. A big part of the change in style was actually due to economics. Keep in mind that in the early days, animation was almost a totally handmade product. I mean, every drawing was drawn by hand. The cells were inked and painted by hand. It was extremely labor-intensive and extremely expensive. Now, in the late 50s and early 60s, we began to use the Xerox process because Xerox was cheaper than having young ladies actually ink the cells by hand.
So that meant you could take your original drawings and put them onto a cell?
Right, exactly. The original drawings were Xeroxed onto the sheets of acetate. And of course, by doing that, that affected the film styling. And so you begin to see a change in the art direction. It's almost as though the technology influenced the art direction of the film. So that's why the films begin to look a little different.
They're a lot looser, I guess.
Yeah, a lot looser, and the more emphasis on line quality. But all of that was influenced by technology and of course, by economics as well.
When you were doing animation for the Disney television show, in those days the show was in black and white. Did you animate in color or in black and white?
Ah, very good. A question that's often asked. The shows were all broadcast in black and white, but Walt Disney was a smart man. He produced the shows in full color.
Because he knew that one day we would sell them on video.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Well, he knew that one day television would be in color.
Uh-huh.
And then he knew that one day these same films could be sold on a media that didn't even exist back in the 50s.
And when you worked for Disney, or any other animation studio other than your own, does the work that you do belong to them, your own drawings? Do the drawings belong to the studio? Could you keep your drawing?
Oh, well, yes. Well, all the work is owned by the company, although artists, you know, certainly artists on occasion would take artwork home. And in a way, that's how a lot of the artwork, fell into the hands of collectors, because artists would take work home, or they would toss drawings in the trash that would eagerly be scooped up by young students. So, but ownership is, Disney owns everything they produce, so everything is copyrighted, everything is owned by the company. But, of course, that still didn't stop a lot of artwork from, getting out of the studio and into the hands.
Migrating home.
Yeah, migrating. Yeah, exactly.
So, Floyd Newman, what are you working on now? What do you do these days?
What I do mostly these days is I write books. I've just completed sort of a memoir of my days at Disney and Pixar, the book you mentioned called My Animated Life. And I've got a couple of other books in work.
Well, where might our listeners find your book, My Animated Life?
Well, my books are sold on an online publishing site called Blurb, B-L-U-R-B, blurb.com. And if you go there, you can find a couple of my books. There's My Animated Life and a gag book that I call Disc Drive. That's also for sale there.
Well, I'm sure we'll all be rushing over there and check it out. Well, Floyd Newman, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. We really appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome. It's always a pleasure to talk about my favorite job.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back again next week for another great show. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Ms. Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. Special thanks this week also to Joe Ferrara and Atlantis Fantasy World in Santa Cruz, California. And, of course, thanks very much to our special guest, Floyd Newman. Check us out on our podcast page. It's KUSP.com. www.comicsandcomicsradio.org, or you can look us up on Facebook and iTunes. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.